Adam?
Yes.
It's Joanne Hickey.
Oh, hi, Joanne. How are you doing?
I'm good. Is this time still good for you?
It's perfect.
Great. Thank you. And I can hear you very clearly.
Wonderful.
That's good. That's a good thing. Adam, I've known your work for so long, and I just don't believe we've ever met.
I don't think so either.
Sadly. Well, we'll have to change that one day, I hope. Certainly not now. But I just thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this and making time. So thank you.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. And it really is sort of, it's humbling when anybody purchases the piece, but just to want to know more is really exciting. Thanks.
Well, I think I gave you a little background about our Syzygy study platform we work with. Did I send you information on that?
You did, but, you know, to be honest, I had a really, really, really hard time with reading comprehension. So I started reading it, and it just got really confusing for me.
Okay. Well, basically, we offer the collection and think of it as a lending library for research and project development and exhibition. It just happens to be all contemporary drawings. So we don't create anything. We just offer it to graduate schools in arts and sciences. They approach us. They design the programs. We lend the work. And it's a great way to get a lot of artists' work out into public venues thoughtfully. And we're gaining momentum. It's a wonderful use of the collection. So what we're trying to add now is an archive of actual artists' voices in the collection. So we'll edit these tape recordings and make them available as student study particular drawings.
Wow, that's really exciting.
Yeah, no, it's worked out well, and we're very excited about its future, and we just kind of keep expanding as a resource for these graduate students. Your work certainly is beautiful, unique, masterfully done, very much appreciated. And but I want to go back and talk to you first about the early years, particularly interested in when and how art began to enter your life.
Gosh, that's a really complicated answer for that.
That's okay.
So I think that, you know, I had, you know, just briefly mentioned having a hard time with reading comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I talk to a lot of artists, and I feel like that is a pretty common thing that artists have. And, you know, I think just maybe in the past couple of years, I've been kind of thinking back to my childhood and where I was with school, with classes, and with like when you're young and impressionable and you're kind of learning to navigate the world and to take in information. And I couldn't really do that. I couldn't read. And it was just so, so, so frustrating. And this is what I don't really know. I don't know if I was drawing, you know, everybody draws. Everybody is making art when they're young. I don't know if I was encouraged to do it more or if I just went to it more. I think I'd like to think that I went to it more, but I don't really know. But certainly at a certain point, it sort of became my language. It became this place where I could not only give myself, but also take in. And I remember, I don't know how old I was, but I grew up in the Washington suburbs, and for school trips.
Washington, D.C. or state?
Yeah.
Okay.
For school field trips, we would oftentimes go to the National Gallery of Art. And I just remember walking through the modern wing of that museum and finding the works of Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko and Robert Ryman and these artists who I just, like, I connected with the work in such a way that it's really indescribable. And I also remember the discussions around the work, and nobody knew how to talk about it. Nobody knew how to take it in. And it was all sort of like the kids that I was with, but also the chaperones and the teachers. They just didn't, they weren't able to work it out. And I don't know if, I certainly don't think I realized it at the time, but later in life, it occurred to me that, like, the way that they were experiencing this work, that to me just like meant so much. And I mean, I didn't know how to think about a Jackson Pollock or a Mark Rothko at like 10 years old or whatever, but I understood it on a level that I feel like they couldn't. And the way that they were talking about their relationship with that work is the exact same thing that I felt every day of my life. Mm-hmm. So it was like things kind of flipped around. And I think also having that exposure to that kind of work, as opposed to, you know, lots of other types of artwork, it opened me up to sort of accepting the idea of not having kind of hard rules or like specific definitions.
You're also speaking about abstract.
Absolutely.
Where so much is left in reading the abstract is left up to your interpretation. So what was your way of reading?
Well, it was, you know, I don't know if it was my way of reading as much as it was like the ability to not have to have everything so straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at or when you think about literature, I mean, you have a language that has, every word has meaning and it's straightforward. Now you can, you know, work within literature and find different ways to interpret things, but the language itself is straightforward. And so, like, I was looking at these works, and they all had a language, and they all had their own language, and it was open to interpretation, but it was also, it just wasn't specific. And I loved that. And I think that it's, that idea has always resonated with me. And as I get older and as I sort of develop as an artist, I'm realizing that those things entered into my life at a really, really early age and in a profound way.
When you were drawing during this time, what were you drawing?
So that's a good question. I don't know if I have the answer to.
You don't have any of the early work?
No, and I certainly don't remember. I mean, not at that age.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always drawing. I never, I think that the immediacy of the drawing, but also it could be that my parents didn't want me working with something that would be really, really messy. But it was always drawing for me.
Were you using graphite or pencils or?
I mean,
colors?
I think, as a kid, I was probably using a lot of colored pencils, I think, and regular graphite pencils. I remember going to these like professional drafting stores that don't exist anymore. And getting these, you know, pretty incredible mechanical pencils that I certainly didn't know how to use, but it was fun to try.
And was some of this being reinforced in school? Were you taking art classes?
Yeah, I mean, I was always sort of looked at as an artist. And I think that having learning disabilities in school in that time, I don't know that the education system knew how to handle me. And I think that because I was, and I don't know if they even saw it as talent, but they saw the drive for me to be making artwork, they sort of encouraged it. And so, you know, there would always be little competitions throughout the school, of, you know, for art or whatever. And I always felt very encouraged to do that. That being said, in high school, and I never really thought about it, but in high school, I almost failed all my art classes. And I think it's because I wasn't following the sort of like the things that they wanted us to do. So I don't know.
Well, you already had a sense of drawing for yourself and what that felt for you, and to have that restricted or confined would have been distasteful, no doubt.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. There's Howard Gardner has written, he's out of Harvard, and he's written a lot about the seven domains of giftedness. And, you know, sometimes when you lose one ability, something else becomes stronger. But he's done some marvelous writing on situations such as yours and what that can become, and recognizes that talent comes in many forms, and interest and passion. And anyway, so I'm always interested in these stories because it's an intellect, but it's just manifested in a different way.
Yeah, it's something that I think a lot about. And I mean, you have the obvious examples of, you know, when people lose their ability to see, their sense of hearing improves, or, you know, their, if they lose their hearing, their sense of sight improves. I think that a lot of people that I talk to that didn't really read when they were young, I think that there's, you have to pay attention to the world in a very different way to get, as a coping mechanism to get through school. Like, I was, you know, I slipped through the cracks, as they say, but I had to kind of bullshit my way through school in order to get out of school. And so I had to, I think, pay attention to things in a lot more nuanced ways. And a lot of people that I know that have had, you know, that have the same things with, you know, with learning disabilities, they all, like, we all kind of have the same coping mechanisms. And I think it just sort of, like, we have to, yeah, just develop a different way of getting through and then seeing the world in a different way. And I don't know, it was very frustrating, and it was really hard. And for, I think, most of my youth, you know, I felt like I wasn't really worthwhile in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And so that was hard, but at the same time, I am very grateful, I think, to have the opportunity to have to sort of force myself to work through the world in a different way. And yeah, I think I just appreciate no definitions in a way that I can't explain.
Did it all change for you when you went off to, you went to the Maryland Institute for your undergrad?
Well, it was really, yes, I did. And that was really weird because that was the first time that I just, like, did really well in school. but to a certain extent, I had always sort of viewed that system as something that I had to fight against. And so I think that I fought against a lot of things at MICA that other people didn't. Yes, I don't know.
Well, was it in, did you find your voice in MICA? I mean, I think I read somewhere where the original drawings you were doing were layered, very dense.
Yeah, so that
drawings.
Happened, yeah, that happened in school, and that was kind of a.
At MICA?
Yeah, at MICA.
Or, yeah, uh-huh.
Sorry.
You were in printmaking, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I was.
Okay.
So I actually went to, during high school, I went to the Corcoran on Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, okay.
And I took open program screen printing classes and, like, just fell in love with it. And I would wake up every Saturday and Sunday at, like, 8 o'clock in the morning as a 15-year-old and go in and take these classes. And it was just, that was probably really where I found my, I don't know if it's where I found my artistic voice, but it's where I found my confidence.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, MICA is when I guess I would say that I came across the language that I'm using now. I don't know. I don't think I really thought about it as a language at the time, but it was something that really resonated with me. It was just this gestural line that really, really resonated with me. And it started off as really, really simple printmaking pieces or etchings. And then I just sort of, when I was just mesmerized by it, or I was just, I think I just felt really comfortable with it.
And this was using the line, and line as I see it interpreted in the current work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
So that,
and where did that come from, do you think?
I don't know exactly where it came from. I think that the line, when I started making those drawings, I was thinking of artists that I really admired, and I felt like maybe I could, you know, finding that line, I could do the things that I had always really liked about these artists. And, I think I would say that. I don't know. It just seemed like it was at the time, it just seemed like a really good tool.
But it came naturally for you, this particular type of line.
I mean, I think it comes naturally to everybody. It came naturally to me, but it also, like, it was less the action of doing the line as much as the what the line gave me the ability to do. And I mean, I certainly didn't think about it at the time, because I would never have thought that I would be doing the work I'm doing now when I started working with that line. But I don't know, like, I think of it in a way sort of maybe like a palette. You know, how a painter has a palette of colors, and they can do all these different things with these different colors. That line is that line opens up so many different opportunities for me. In a weird way, maybe the restrictive quality of that one or that texture.
So you were expressing it through printmaking. And then what happened?
I took a drawing class. And I guess I was also sort of thinking...
At MICA.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I was sort of thinking about what I was going to do when I got out of school, because, you know, being an artist that works in printmaking, you're tied to having to have access to studio equipment. And so I was, you know, kind of thinking about what I was going to do in the next couple of years in my studio if I didn't have access to etching presses and whatnot. And so I was also taking this drawing class. I took a handful of drawing classes. One was the class that was literally called abstract drawing, I think. And the professor introduced us to a lot of artists and just really let us run wild. And that was probably the moment where I just really, really put my nose to the grindstone and focused on pushing that drawing as far as I could. And then, of course, it changed, but I'm still...
So when you were doing that as far as you could, were you using, what kind of drawing material were you using?
So it was all graphite on paper. It was all different hardnesses of pencil.
And different sizes?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
there's just layering. You're putting layer and layer.
Yeah, and so when I say layering, I think it's confusing because now I'm working with layer, but it's sort of a different thing. But, yes, I mean, I'm just – so with those drawings in college, they started out a little bit looser and not as dense, but then I just got really, really, really involved in the process of making them. And after that class and, you know, throughout the rest of my career in school and even a few years after college, I was just making these really, really, really dense drawings where I was just, it was kind of like a meditation where I was just drawing on the same sheet of paper for hours and hours and hours and hours at a time. And then ultimately, I guess at the point where I felt like I needed to change, to push myself a little bit further, they all looked the same. The drawings.
Well, they must have been so dense and burnished that you really didn't see the line much.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. And, you know, they were interesting to me, but I think that they stopped being quite as interesting to me. And they certainly weren't as interesting to other people. But when I was in college, there was another professor that was doing these cut muslin pieces. And there were these amazing installations where she printed these patterns on muslin and then she'd cut the patterns out. And I remember seeing the exhibition and thinking, it would be really fun to try that, but there's no way I can do that. I don't have the time and I don't have the patience to do that. And then, yeah, I guess a couple years after graduation, her name is Piper Shepherd. She was doing a piece and she was hiring people to help her work. And I ended up being one of those people. And I think that that moment helped me think, or helped me realize that it was something that I could do and how much I enjoyed it.
You were cutting with scissors?
So we were cutting with X-Acto knives. And muslin is like, and I could be incorrect about the material that she was using, but it's kind of like a stiff but really, really thin, like cotton. So it wasn't really that different than the paper that I used.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had helped her cut and maybe sat on it for a little while and then gave it a shot. But I was really worried that she would be upset that I was doing that. So I called her, emailed her, whatever, asking her if she wanted it, which is kind of hilarious to think about now.
Well, I can't imagine she didn't do anything but encourage you.
She was really pleased. She was very excited. And I think that I felt like it's not what made her work, but I felt like at the time I was worried that what made her work was the wonder of the process in her pieces. And I think that's what I was thinking my work was about with the cut work when I started, which I certainly don't think now. Although, I mean, I do think that a lot of people enter the work through that way. So, but I was worried.
Well, when you look at a completed piece, it's rather confounding.
Yeah.
And beautiful, but and does draw you in and keep you captivated. And so much too is with the tonal values of the graphite.
Thank you.
They're beautiful. So then you just set out to create this new idea or transfer it to your purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was just sort of like I looked at it as the next logical step.
Mm-hmm.
And the first cut pieces that I did, my original intention was that I would make a drawing with really, really light pencil lines, cut around the pencil line, kind of like what I'm doing now, but not cutting to the edge of the line, just kind of giving a halo around the line. And as I was working in my apartment at the time to store the pieces, I just pinned them to the wall. So I just stuck a pin through two of the holes on the top. And as I did more pieces, I just, rather than putting them next to each other on the wall, because I had a really small apartment, I just put them on top. So they became these layered pieces. And I remember sitting and looking at those layered pieces, kind of with that same feeling when I was looking at Piper's work originally, thinking that would be amazing if I could do that. But there's no way that I could have, I just don't have the time to take sort of one drawing to be multiple layers. And so my first show, it was maybe five drawings, single sheet drawings. With no layers, but like, mm-hmm. I couldn't handle that. After the show, I just started doing layered pieces.
Well, the depth you came to know when you were doing all those layers of the black, dark drawings.
Yeah.
It would never be as fulfilling. It would be so flat.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Well, the work, I mean, it certainly is meditative in when I think about the process for you.
Yeah.
And given all of your experience with drawing and drawing this line over and over, and that part of it has to almost physically do itself for you, and then controlling the X-Acto knife, as I imagine. But it's so meticulous.
So I kind of feel like the meticulous aspect of the work I don't know if it's as it is meticulous, but I don't think it is. It doesn't feel that way to me at all. I've done it for so long that what seems meticulous to me is just very kind of calming and soothing.
I guess in a way you're drawing with the X-Acto knife.
I'm tracing. I mean, like,
yeah,
but
you are drawing. I mean, you are cutting a line with the X-Acto knife.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that there was the drawing on the back side, which is...
No, it's not. The drawing is on the front side.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, so...
Okay, I thought the drawing was on the back side.
Right. No, so the tone that you're seeing in all of the drawings, that's the color of the graphite. Now, in the past handful of years, I've been working in color, so the process has changed a little bit. But the grayscale work, all of that gray is the color of the graphite. So if you have a piece that has some dark lines and some light lines, that's the nature of the hardness of the graphite.
Have you varied the paper you use? Are there often different papers, or it's all the same?
So it's all the same paper. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it took me a little bit of time when I started doing the cutting to find the right paper for me, just like the paper that I like to draw on, but also a paper that's relatively easy to cut through. So it's all the same paper.
Okay.
You know, I had mentioned working with color lately. So what I do now, and it's kind of interesting. It's definitely the reason I approach it this way is because of my printmaking background. So what I do now is I work with a printmaker and we work together where she runs paper through a litho press with kind of like a relief process. To print color on the paper that I use.
Okay.
And then, so it's a solid sheet of color, and then I draw on top of that with the pencil in the cutaway.
Okay.
So,
what prompted the introduction of color?
I got divorced about 4 years ago, and I think that I just, when I tried to get back to work, it just didn't feel right to just stay doing the same thing. I was married for 13 years, and I just felt like I needed to change something serious in my work. And I'm really glad that I did. I don't know that I feel as comfortable with what I'm doing now as I was when I was working in grayscale, but I kind of like that.
Well, it's still fairly new in your practice, so you have to keep working it, experimenting and moving it. Color is a whole different thing.
It's changed the work so much.
Yeah. And you have to find what feels right, but that takes time and experimentation. I wanted to ask you, what do you do for levity? You know, I mean, a lot of artists keep journals or sketchbooks or doodle, or I know people don't like that word, but they find ways of escaping from the rigors of their day-to-day practice to still be creative and expressive, but in a more spontaneous way. What do you have in your studio practice that allows you that space?
I don't think I do anything. I work a lot. I think my work takes a lot of time, but I also love it. And that sort of that meditation is also kind of my therapy. If I leave my studio to go visit family, for instance, when I come back, it's a little bit hard to get back into focus. And there's always a moment of like pretty deep depression until I can get back focused with my work.
Do you play with scale much?
I do play with scale, but while I'm working on the body of work, the work is all the same size. And that's, that's probably been only the last 10 years or so. So now all of my shows are all pieces of the same size. And I actually think that the restriction of the line that really opened up the ability for me to experiment. I think the restriction of scale gives me that same thing. And I can really sort of focus on other things But after I finish a body of work, then I go to another scale, and that's always kind of exciting.
Yeah. Have you done artist residencies?
I have not. I'm a little bit on the fence about it. I would like the idea of it, but my life is kind of an artist residency. And there's so many people that residency offers them the ability to focus on their work. And I might feel a little bit awkward about taking that spot from somebody. It's not to say that I haven't applied to residencies before, but it's not something that I continually applied to do.
And what about, do you have many studio visits?
I don't. I maybe have one a month or something, but I don't typically.
And typically, what is a studio visit about for you? How does that come to be? Are they coming to look at a specific piece? Is it a dealer bringing somebody to look at your process? What is it?
It is usually people that I know. They're not typically collectors or dealers. They're usually people that are kind of outside of the art world that I know.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the discussion kind of goes into process, but I won't really do a studio visit unless I have a body of work to look at.
Do you keep an archive of all of the images of the work you've ever created?
I used to. I do. But again, the divorce sort of changed, I don't know. Like, it screwed up a lot of stuff. So everything pre-divorce.
Well, got you all off balance.
Totally. I'm not complaining about it. It was a really good thing.
Right.
But I think, I don't know, I had images of everything that I made after, you know, once I started cutting, I would document the work. And so that was quite a few images that I don't have documentation anymore of. But, you know, if I really needed it, I think I could find it from galleries that I've worked with before. Mm-hmm.
How many galleries are you working with now?
Right now, I'm working with Brian Gross in San Francisco, and with Rule, based out of
Denver.
Yeah,
I see.
I was working with Margaret Thatcher, but we stopped working together a little bit over a year ago.
Well, you worked with her for quite a while, because I think that's where I got the work originally.
A very long
Margaret
time.
Thatcher. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, just a wonderful experience with her.
Uh-huh.
I think that just the landscape of the gallery artist landscape has changed a lot in New York, and I think we were on very different pages, unfortunately.
What are you thinking for the future? How would you like things to evolve, barring what we're going through right now, obviously? But do you have ideas in your head about where you want to take the work?
Well, I don't. The way that I work typically is that, you know, the work takes so long. So the piece that I'm working on now actually started just around a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to be another 2 months or so before it's finished.
Mm-hmm.
The piece I do after that is just going to be a response to what I'm working on now.
Mm-hmm.
And then the piece after that is going to be a response to that. And it's
okay.
And I think that...
So that's how it evolves.
Yeah. I mean, I had done some really large scale pieces in the past. And I'd like to go back to doing that. But... it takes so much out of me physically. I mean, the idea of spending over a year on a piece again, while it sounds wonderful, I can't afford to do that. Although with what's going on now, things are changing so much that I don't know. Yeah, there's just so much uncertainty that, I don't know how galleries are going to fare this. I don't know how what typical collectors, how they're going to react. The economy, you know, in 2008, it affected things so drastically for me. And so I'm a little bit scared about how that is going to affect things for me again. But at the same time, I think so many people that I know that are creative, I think we're, I don't mean to sound glib, I think that we're kind of thriving in this moment in a way. And I think it's because we're able to focus on something that we're able to sort of let the noise out.
Well, we've had to slow down, and slowing down is something we've long needed to do.
Yeah.
To give yourself time to really be and feel and look and think.
Yeah.
I think artists are benefiting hugely from that aspect of it. And my guess is, and you tell me, with the quarantine and all the way that you work, has it impacted you in directly any way?
It's impacted me a lot less than it has other people.
Sure. That's what I'm saying, because
yeah.
of the way you work.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned several times now this idea of time.
Yeah.
And time seems like it's an issue for you. When you're talking about doing a big work and the commitment.
I mean, it's a restriction. I think that the big work, I would love to do it, but financially it's just prohibitive.
So why wouldn't you be able to do some smaller works at the same time you're working on a big work?
Oh, I can't. I can only work on one piece at a time. I think because, I don't know. I guess it's just one long thought that I'm working on.
Have you tried going back to just straight drawing? Have you returned to that without the slicing?
I have not. And I will say that the joy that I got out of straight drawing, so now when I make my pieces, I enjoy the drawing, but the drawing is a challenge. And not that I mind challenge, but the cutting is where I find the joy that I found when I was doing really big. Just
so you just don't feel the drawing itself until it's cut and layered.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, you give me a lot to think about here. do you have any advice one piece of advice you'd offer a graduate student coming out into the arena that isn't covered in typical pedagogy?
Oh, gosh. I think that not that you have to be young to be coming out of graduate school, but I think that like your approach is young when you're in school, and I think that a lot of the things that frustrate younger artists is maybe a lack of faith in their own work or a lack of trust in their own work. I think for me personally, I dealt with that a lot growing up, and art was an opportunity where I could have complete trust in myself. But I see a lot of people in school and just out of school that are constantly worried about how their work lives in the world and how other people perceive it. And I think to have just a true and meaningful voice and a meaningful impact, you have to have complete faith in your work and not and let everything else kind of out of your mind when you're making your work.
What do you think the I'm curious, I have my own thoughts on this, but what do you think about the MFA exhibitions and what goes on there?
I'm not sure I understand. Are you talking about the MFA in general, or
no? At the end of your MFA, they have this big exhibition, right?
Okay, so I don't have an MFA, and I...
Oh, you only got the BFA.
Yeah.
Okay, right, you didn't do the MFA, right. Okay, so you can't talk about that. What years were you at MICA?
I graduated in 2001.
And oh, okay.
I got in 97.
Okay. Because I was living in Baltimore then.
Oh.
Yeah. I was in Baltimore from 92 to 2002.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I have a lot of friends at the Maryland Institute.
Okay. So do you know Howie Lee Weiss by any chance?
No.
Okay. He was the abstract drawing.
I wasn't collecting drawings at the time, but, you know, I was interested in art, clearly, and was somewhat involved in the arts in Baltimore. So, yeah, it's a really good school. It's an interesting environment to be in as an artist too, I think.
Yeah, and I have to say it was a little bit, it was a tough place to be for a lot of reasons. The crime when I was there was really hard.
Right.
And so it was really isolating.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't really go out after dark very much.
Right.
And when you did, it was like there was this anxiety of getting attacked. but the other students
riddled with crime for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I've covered about everything I wanted to cover with you. I'm really grateful. I think, you know, every artist is adding something uniquely theirs to this archive of conversations, and all of it, I think I'm getting bits and pieces from everybody that I find really quite profound. And so I'm really happy that we had this chance to talk and I hear more about your story, and I want to cheer you on. You know, what I say to all artists is just keep working. It's what, you know, your concerns for kids coming right out of grad school or undergraduate school, all you can do is keep working. And the other piece of advice I give, and I will give that to you here, is that it's the life you live that you put into your work. So maybe mixing it up for you, Adam, and putting yourself into a residency might open some new avenues for you.
Yeah.
Work doesn't have to change at all, but the idea of some of these residencies where you're in a mix of other creative thinkers, you're in a new environment that takes you out of your comfort zone, shakes things up. I have never seen an artist go to a residency when the work didn't advance when they got back. It didn't happen immediately, but over a period of time, it's a push. It gets you out of your comfort zone and advances the work in wonderful ways. And so, if I were to offer you one bit of advice based on our conversation today, I would say look into residencies, find one that's, you know, is there a kind of environment you really love and enjoy, find one and give it a whirl. It doesn't have to be for 6 months or 2 months. It can be whatever you want, but what you are, who you are, how you live is what you bring to your work. And to keep it growing and advancing, you have to do so as an individual as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, and I appreciate the push.
So I'm giving you just a little kick. But I'm watching your work, and I will continue to do so. I love it in the collection, and it certainly is always appreciated. So keep working. And thank you so much for today.
Well, again, and thank you, and thank you for your support, but also thanks for doing this project, because I don't know, it's pretty meaningful to feel like what I'm doing goes outside of, into the world in different ways, and this is a really big different way. And I appreciate
Well, your
that.
Story is compelling. You know, you had to work under extraordinary handicaps for so many years, and the idea of drawing being a language, and it is your language, and you found language through art, which art is a language. I mean, all of this is powerful stuff for kids coming out of grad school or undergrad school. I mean, I work mostly with graduates, but so many of them have struggled, and so it gives them hope to hear this kind of story. And this is life. This is real.
Yeah.
So you are speaking and you do have a voice, and it's through your work, and that's the magic. So anyway, you be well. And I'm going to have to look more closely at the colored work. I haven't really seen any of the colored work firsthand. I've only seen it through the computer, and I don't trust color on that. So
it's hard.
Yeah, I know. That's another discussion and for another time. Yeah. World. So enjoy the rest of your day, and thank you so much. Bye,
thank
Adam.
You. Goodbye.